It's Friday, May 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd reporting from Washington. Coming up, the Islamic State captures the city of Palmyra.
It's just another symptom of this tragedy that's happening in Syria, the loss of life and the destruction of a country that really is, you know, one of the few places that indeed is a crossroads of history.
President Obama designates Tunisia as a major U.S. ally. The Senate clears the way for a new trade authority for the president. That plus Sam Smith recovers from surgery, coming up on VOA's International Edition. The Islamic State group is now in control of the famed Roman-era ruins of the ancient city of Palmyra, just hours after seizing the Syrian town from government forces. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the Islamic militants took over the 2,000-year-old UNESCO World Heritage Site late Wednesday. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with David Lesh of Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He says that Palmyra's loss is not only a tragedy for world heritage, but also challenges the Syrian government's claims that it can protect its own people and its heritage.
This is one of the few sites in the entire world of the Roman era there where you can see the entire city planning. It's a huge loss to the history, to archaeology. It pains me significantly, but more so, it's just another symptom of this tragedy that's happening in Syria and the loss of life and the destruction of a country that really is, you know, one of the few places that indeed is a crossroads of history. Many places claim to be such, but Syria, along with Turkey and some other countries in that area, such as Iraq, really are these crossroads of history, where in one place, in one country, you know, you have Crusader castles and you have Roman ruins, you have magnificent Islamic architecture all in one place. And it's just a tragedy that adds to the human tragedy, the loss of this heritage and history of this country.
Palmyra also has strategic military value, home to a modern army installation situated on a desert highway linking Damascus with the eastern provinces. Is this a serious blow to Syria's army?
I wouldn't say it's a serious blow, but it is the continuance of a series of losses that the regime has experienced in the last month or so. They've lost Idlib and Jishashagur in the northeast part of the country to a new coalition of opposition elements. Now they've lost Palmyra to ISIS. They've lost some areas in southern Syria, particularly along the Jordanian border. ISIS made some inroads into some Palestinian refugee camps outside of Damascus. From the regime perspective, it's a troubling pattern of losses along the fringes. And I think what has happened is that the regime is overextended. You know, the regime has a horizon in terms of their economic and manpower resources. So this combination of losses at the hands of two different prongs of the opposition, in my view, is symptomatic of this horizon. So it's more symbolic than strategic. I think the regime itself, having been overextended over the past few months, is contracting in terms of getting into a more consolidated strategic position that is more in line with its resource base. However, again, more symbolically, I think it hurts the regime more so than strategically right now.
Islamic State has the reputation of destroying ancient sites, including Nimrud in northern Iraq. VOA's Jeff Young spoke with Georgetown University professor Mark Vlasic, who says that ISIL tends to use destruction of larger artifacts to show off while pillaging smaller antiquities to fill its pockets.
What's happening in the region is tragic, and I think if you look at what ISIS has done in past situations, they tend to focus on the larger issue, larger targets, and blow those up for effect, for propaganda value. And things that are smaller, that are movable, they tend to take out and try to sell on the black market to raise money for the terrorist operations. And so I think it's a bit of propaganda value, using the smokescreen of that destruction to basically cover what they're also trying to do, which is raise money for their operations in the region.
What is in Palmyra that is able to be packed up and crated off and sold on the black market? Mostly I see huge buildings. What else is there?
So like most archaeological sites, you have a combination between the large structures that you see in pictures, and things that people would actually like to have in their homes or their gardens. And I think that's the challenge for many of these locations, that there are things that, you know, obviously are not going to be moved out of the area. And frankly, if they were, they're so noticeable that if they ever went to the marketplace, people would know where they came from. There'll be other antiquities that are either placed at one of the museums that are there, or placed underground where they can dig these things up and bring them into the black market. And that's, I think, the big concern is antiquities that no one knows about that are underground now. They're being, could be excavated for these individuals and put in some marketplace, because there's no way of tracking what you don't know exists.
The siege of Palmyra comes just days after Islamic State fighters captured Iraq's western city of Ramadi. The advances are calling into question the effectiveness of U.S. efforts to defeat the extremist group. For a look at how the world is responding, that is, to this story, we turn to our social media specialist, Michael Lippin. Michael, what are people saying?
Thanks, David. Well, the plight of Palmyra remains the top story right now on the VOA English website, where we have an in-depth report by our Middle East correspondent, Jamie Detmer. Our audience has been commenting about Palmyra on several platforms. On Twitter, a user with the handle @Santa's Tavern says, "One can only hope that the Syrian government has rigged the depot that is near Palmyra, that people are concerned that the militants may get their hands on, that the Syrian government has rigged that depot to blow up before the Islamic State can do anything with it." On the Voice of America Facebook page, Fahad Nasir Sandu asks, "What is the President of the United States doing about this? He must save this site at Palmyra from these non-human creatures who are ruining every dignity of humanity." Well, that comment drew a response from Dwayne Fitzhugh, who wrote this, "Why must the U.S. be the world's savior? You speak of the President, yet you are forgetting we as citizens do not want to get involved in your conflict." Now, on the VOA website itself, we have at least 9 comments at the bottom of the main article about Palmyra. Here's one from Bill Webb in Phoenix, Arizona. He writes, "Although many countries have signed on to the anti-Islamic State coalition in some capacity, the U.S. has done more through its bombing campaign than any other country. U.S. ground troops should be out of the question. It's the affected surrounding countries that must complete the destruction of IS to ensure the sovereignty of Iraq and Syria." Well, that's a look at what our audience has been saying on the various platforms. David?
All right. Thank you, Michael. We invite your comments. You can visit our website. That's www.voanews.com. We're also on Facebook at www.facebook.com/Voice of America. Coming up, President Obama's trade authority clears a hurdle in the U.S. Senate, and Grammy winner Sam Smith recovers from surgery. That's coming up on International Edition.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. President Barack Obama on Thursday designated Tunisia as a major non-NATO ally of the United States, praising its democratic reforms in the aftermath of the Arab Spring. Mr. Obama met at the White House with Tunisian President Baji Kaid Essebsi. Mr. Obama said he was pleased to hear of Tunisia's political change to a democracy. He said the North African nation plays a key role in regional stability.
Given the instability in the region, it is important for us to continue to partner effectively in counterterrorism efforts, but also in our efforts to stabilize Libya and bring the parties together so that we don't have a failed state and a power vacuum that ends up infecting the situation in Tunisia as well.
The American leader pledged short-term U.S. aid for Tunis to complete its economic reforms and to combat unemployment.
And I committed that as Tunisia continues to embark on important structural reforms to the economy, that we will not only provide short-term aid, but also try to provide the kind of bridge and support that's necessary to complete those reforms and make sure that they're effective and benefiting the people of Tunisia.
President Essebsi, the first democratically elected leader in Tunisia's 60-year history, told Mr. Obama that his country's transformation continues to be threatened by terrorist groups. The North African nation becomes the 16th non-NATO country the U.S. has designated as a major ally. The move strengthens the military and financial links between the two countries while not creating a mutual defense agreement. Tunisia's longtime president, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, was ousted by democratic protests in 2011 that inspired the Arab Spring uprisings across North Africa and the Middle East. The country has since held several successful elections, and despite bouts of violence, Tunisia's secular and Islamist parties have largely avoided the turmoil that spread through other Arab Spring countries. But in March, a terrorist attack killed 22 people at the country's National Bardo Museum. The attack was claimed by the Islamic State, which raised concerns about the government's ability to stop terror attacks. Now for a look at the day's headlines, here's VOA's Dave DeForest.
And here are the headlines from VOA. Islamic State insurgents have overrun the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra and its historic ruins. However, U.S. President Barack Obama says he does not believe the United States is losing its fight with Islamic State insurgents. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe says both sides of the Ukrainian conflict have been violating the terms of a ceasefire agreement. Speaking to the German parliament in Berlin Thursday, Chancellor Angela Merkel says it is unimaginable for Russia to participate in a meeting of the world's leading industrialized countries as long as it is involved in the conflict in Ukraine. Myanmar says it will work to protect members of a Muslim minority that are risking their lives to flee the country. And U.S. President Barack Obama's trade proposals scored a big victory Thursday when senators advanced a bill to facilitate approval of a 12-nation Pacific Rim free trade pact. I'm Dave DeForest, VOA News.
And you're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. President Barack Obama has been pushing for what is called fast-track trade authority. That would give him the ability to present trade pacts to Congress, which could then either accept it or deny it. However, he has run into opposition from some members of his own party who say that authorizing the president to use that kind of trade authority could result in U.S. jobs being shipped overseas. Well, Mr. Obama's agenda scored a major victory Thursday when senators advanced a bill to facilitate approval of the Pacific Rim Free Trade Pact. As VOA's Michael Bowman reports, the Senate voted to conclude debate on trade promotion authority, which will allow Congress to approve or deny the pacts, but not to change them.
The 62-38 vote exceeded the 3/5 majority required and all but assures final Senate passage of Trade Promotion Authority, or TPA, for which only a simple majority is required. That vote could come as early as Friday. Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell hailed the outcome.
I'm very happy the Senate has decided to take another step forward on this very important initiative.
TPA, also known as Fast Track, would speed approval of the Trans-Pacific Partnership of Nations that account for about 40% of global economic output. TPA and TPP have overwhelming Republican support, as well as the backing of a handful of pro-trade Democrats, a coalition that prevailed despite fierce efforts by opponents to block or delay the bill's advancement. Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown objected to ending debate before scores of proposed amendments to the legislation had been aired.
We make decisions here that throw people out of work. We're going to vote on this without even having amendments on how to take care of those workers and how to do trade enforcement. It simply doesn't make sense.
TPA's author, Republican Senator Orrin Hatch, said the chamber could vote on a series of amendments prior to the bill's final passage.
We need to get this bill passed. We need to pass it for the American workers who want good, high-paying jobs. We need to pass it for our farmers, ranchers, manufacturers, and entrepreneurs who need access to foreign markets in order to compete. We need to pass it to maintain our standing in the world.
Trade is not strictly a partisan issue on Capitol Hill. For example, Republican Senator Jeff Sessions voted against advancing TPA, arguing that Congress should not surrender its right to amend trade deals and protect American workers.
As in the past, it appears this agreement will clearly reduce jobs. and reduce wages, too, and reduce manufacturing. We can't be a strong nation without a manufacturing sector. We just cannot.
Should it pass the Senate, TPA would face even more intense opposition in the House of Representatives, which would vote before President Obama could sign it into law. The bill grants fast-track powers for a six-year period, meaning the president's successor would also have use of the tool. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
This is BizBeat.
General Motors rolled out the Chevy Volt plug-in hybrid electric in 2011. Today, fuel prices have dropped substantially, creating less consumer incentive for hybrids and all-electric cars in some places. Analyst Bruce Pazowski says sales fluctuations are to be expected.
As the manufacturers really work on developing better batteries, that's really going to help turn the corner on the pure electrics as well as for hybrids.
In Europe, though, petrol remains relatively expensive and sales of all electric vehicles are up compared to last year. In the first quarter of 2015, EV sales in the European Union are up 58% from last year, outpacing the U.S. But economist Nick Loris at the Heritage Foundation says EVs need more work to become mainstream.
I think it's about the dollar, it's about reliability, it's about comfort.
And infrastructure. EV charging stations remain scarce. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
British crooner Sam Smith was a big winner at this year's Grammy Awards, taking home four of the trophies, including Best New Artist, Song of the Year, and Record of the Year. But Smith's soulful voice has been silenced for the next few weeks. VOA's Philip Alexio and Ray McDonald tell us why.
All right, VOA 1 host Ray McDonald here to talk about Mr. Sam Smith, who had some surgery, this great singer. What's going on with him?
Hey, Phil. Well, he may have won multiple Grammys and sold about 5 million copies of his album In the Lonely Hour, but the man went under the knife last week, or the laser, as the case may be. Back in April, Sam Smith began canceling shows after his doctor told him he needed surgery for a vocal cord hemorrhage. Now, of course, as you know, vocal cords vibrate against each other to produce sound. And when a blood vessel bursts, it causes bruising. Now, the reason for this? Well, we're not exactly sure. It could have just happened at a party where he raised his voice. Or it also could have happened because of the type of singing Sam does. Sam hits very high notes. He really gets up there. And this causes some additional stress to the vocal cords. Whatever happened, the doctor said, you have to cancel your shows. You have to get into the hospital. And that's exactly what happened. He underwent surgery last week at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. And the good news is he's expected to make a full recovery.
Now, this is a young guy.
Yeah, and he's
23 only, years old.
He's in his early 20s, you know. He has his whole career in front of him, and the doctors are saying this should not unduly affect him. His voice may be different going from here on out, but he's in good hands. The same doctor who operated on Sam also worked on Steven Tyler of Aerosmith, Lionel Richie, and Adele. All of them have come back stronger than ever. The downside for Sam is that he's not allowed to sing or even talk for the next 3 weeks. And he was all over Twitter saying, how am I going to do this? You know, I'm a loquacious guy. I love to sing. I love to talk. Yeah. This is going to be tough for me. That's par for the course because, like any other muscles, the vocal cords need time to heal. His next live show is scheduled for July 18th, and let's hope he's okay for that.
All right, so he's a four-time Grammy winner, if I have that right.
Right, right. And it's tough out there for a professional musician. These days, touring is your most assured route to riches. So you got to go out there, you got to sing, you got to be at the top of your game night after night. Dr. Michelle Yagoda of the Lenox Hill Hospital in Brooklyn says it's like playing the World Series nonstop. And she says Sam Smith's voice will likely change in some form after this procedure, but it'll probably be for the better, and he'll be able to hit those notes more clearly. He's going to have to take care of himself, though.
Good luck to you, Mr. Sam Smith. And once again, VOA One host, Ray McDonald. Thanks a lot, Ray.
Hey, thanks a lot, Phil. Here's Sam, by the way, back in the days when he could sing. This is his current hit single, Lay Me Down.
I'm reaching out to you. Can you hear my call? Missing you like crazy.
Thanks for joining us for VOA's International Edition. We welcome your comments on our show. You can post them on our website, www.voanews.com. That's also where you can download copies of our show or any of your favorite VOA programs. Tracy Carter directed our show today. Dave Magnus was our engineer. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is gravely concerned about the plight of thousands of Rohingya and Bangladeshi migrants stranded at sea in Southeast Asia. Many of the migrants are Rohingya, a minority Muslim population in Burma. Burma refuses to recognize the Rohingya as Burmese citizens. They have been subjected to severe discrimination and violence, with Burmese authorities enforcing disproportionate restrictions on their movement. In Rakhine State, tens of thousands live as internally displaced persons in camps, with little access to livelihoods, markets, food, or places of worship. They have become vulnerable to human traffickers, who promise them a better life if they leave the country by boat. Up to an estimated 500,000 undocumented Rohingya and 32,000 registered Rohingya refugees also live in neighboring Cox's Bazar district, Bangladesh, as well as other countries in the region. Now, thousands of migrants are stranded in vessels in the Bay of Bengal, Andaman Sea, and Strait of Malacca, with little food or water, and many are reportedly in desperate shape. The governments of Indonesia, Malaysia, and Thailand have offered some assistance to the migrants and have already allowed nearly 4,000 to land on their shores in recent days. Indonesia and Malaysia have now agreed to take in another 7,000 and asked the international community to help them with this humanitarian effort. The United States urges all the countries of the region to work together quickly to save the lives of the migrants now at sea who are in need of an immediate rescue effort. As U.S. State Department Press Office Director Jeff Rathke said, this is an emergency that we believe needs to be addressed with appropriate speed and resolve through a regionally coordinated effort to save the lives of thousands of vulnerable migrants and asylum seekers. In addition, Mr. Rathke said that the humanitarian situation of the Rohingyas in Burma's Rakhine State needs attention, as does the need to create a path to citizenship for stateless persons, issues the United States has and will continue to raise with the Burmese government. He also called on Burmese authorities to address the migrant smuggling and human trafficking of the Rohingya. On May 29th, the government of Thailand will host a regional conference in Bangkok to discuss and formulate a constructive solution to the plight of the migrants. The United States is sending a senior delegation to the conference and will remain intensely engaged with regional governments to encourage a rapid response to this desperate humanitarian crisis.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back. We are here to tell you about our world and help you learn American English. We begin today with a story of terrible violence in Texas. You may have heard that biker gangs were involved in a recent clash. Then something a lot more pleasant. Some young people from Washington, D.C. are learning their schoolwork at a very unusual place. The program is called As It Is, and it begins right now. Texas police are guarding against violence after a clash between competing motorcycle gangs. 9 people were killed in the fighting last Sunday in the city of Waco, Texas. Waco police say they seized more than 100 guns and arrested about 170 people. It was one of the worst gunfights in recent United States history. The gunfight has led police and others to look closely at motorcycle gangs, bikers who travel together on their motorcycles. Law enforcement officials say such groups are a great threat to public safety. Police say the gunfight in Waco was a clash between a large Texas-based gang called the Banditos and smaller gangs, including one called the Cossacks. Sergeant Patrick Swanton is a member of the Waco Police Department.
I will tell you that in 34 years of law enforcement, this is the worst crime scene, the most violent crime scene that I have ever been involved in.
Sergeant Swanton says police knew the gangs were gathering in Waco and followed them closely as they traveled to the city. Some police officers were sent to a Waco restaurant. Sergeant Swanton says they were prepared to take action if the two sides fought.
We were extremely fortunate to have our best, most well-trained officers here, and that was our tactical unit. They were here for the specific reason of we knew there was going to be trouble at this biker event.
Sergeant Swanton says the gang members fired at each other, and some also fired at the police. But only gang members were wounded or killed. Federal and state officials say the Banditos gang has about 2,000 members. They say it is involved in the transport of illegal drugs and other kinds of organized crime. The Banditos was formed in South Texas in the 1960s. It now has allied chapters or smaller groups in other states and in several countries. James Quinn teaches sociology at the University of North Texas. He has studied biker gangs. He says one chapter can operate differently from another. He notes that some gangs have what he calls a sophisticated membership that is active in organized crime. Other chapters appeal to those interested in riding, drinking, or making friends. The Hells Angels biker group is based in California. It competes with the Banditos for members. Hells Angels is much larger than the Banditos. Yet both groups have chapters throughout the country and the world. The two groups have clashed in Australia, Western Europe, and Canada. Canadian reporter Julian Scher has written 2 books about the gangs. Mr. Scher says the level of violence may decrease for a time after the gunfight in Waco. But he says the two sides will fight again someday because biker gangs always fight.
The image of the biker gangs really never changes. This is what they're about. This is their very nature. And it was just pure luck that there were no innocent people killed in that shootout, but there have been cases where innocent people have been killed.
Most of those arrested in Waco belong to the Banditos group. City officials are worried that other Banditos members could travel to Waco and fight with members of competing groups who are still there. State police and federal officials are in Waco to help local police investigate the gunfight and to prevent more violence. I'm Jim Tedder. You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. The spring term is coming to an end at colleges and universities across the United States. The past few weeks were a busy time for many students, including those at Washington Adventist University near Washington, D.C. Some students from the university have been helping poor, mostly immigrant children with their schoolwork. But the students did not work with the boys and girls at a traditional school. Every Thursday night, they have been meeting at a laundromat, a place where people go to wash their clothes. Christopher Jones Cruz reports.
Every week, many people bring their clothing and their children to the Rainbow Coin Laundry. While the parents wash the clothes, the children are busy learning. Some children completed their schoolwork with help from Washington Adventist University student Heather Alas.
We want to help the little kids with their homework. A lot of them don't understand English all that well. So we do try to make sure that they understand their homework because sometimes their parents aren't able to help as well.
Christine Sumampao is also a tutor in the program. She says the program began with just five children, but has grown to about 20. She has been writing a marketing plan for Nuk Kim, the owner of the laundromat. They created the idea of a tutoring program to give people a reason to keep coming to the laundromat.
He's really friendly with his customers, so we figure why don't we try something that he can give to the community.
The project began last year when Nuk Kim asked Kimberly Pichot for help. Ms. Pichot is the head of the university's business department.
When we first started working with him, business was bad, which is why we came in. He'd even considered closing his business. But the conversation got started, and we said, okay, let's do a facelift. Let's redesign his logo. And the ideas just started coming. And as we were brainstorming, one student says, you know, there's a lot of immigrant children hanging around. Why don't we add tutoring?
Mr. Kim says the laundromat is slowly getting more business. The project is part of an international entrepreneurial program called Enactus. It was launched in the United States 40 years ago. The program is now at more than 1,700 college and university campuses in 36 countries.
They want to give students experience before they graduate. And so we collaborate with the community and with businesses, and we find things that the students can do to enhance the community.
Ms. Pichot says her students are working with other businesses in addition to the Rainbow Coin Laundry.
Every year we start the year out with a small business symposium, and we invite any business to come in. It's a free workshop. And so from that symposium, we self-select. We see who wants to work with whom. And then throughout the year, we help other businesses with accounting, with taxes, with marketing, cost analysis, a variety of things. So this year, we've worked with a restaurant. We just started working with a tax service to help them expand to a second location. We've worked with sports trainers to help expand a dance club.
She says the students help business owners increase their profits while gaining experience that they cannot get in school.
And so the depth of their learning is a world apart from just that dry classroom environment where they walk away with a few concepts. They volunteer long hours.
Christine Sumampao is completing her studies this year. She has spent about 1,000 hours as a volunteer. That is more than any other student in the group. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report.
As an English learner, you want to be able to understand and to discuss a subject. You want to have the ability to express your opinions and to support that opinion with a clear argument. You can learn these skills by learning how to debate. In everyday conversation, Americans use the word debate to talk about discussions among people. When people debate, they give their own opinions about a topic. Another use of the word debate describes a more formal discussion. Debaters work on a team to convince a judge that their opinion about a topic has more value than the opposite side's opinion.
Debate is part of the tradition of forensics started in ancient Greece. The Greeks thought that in a democracy, people needed to have certain skills. These skills included speaking in public in favor of an opinion and providing evidence to support one's opinion. The Greeks supported the development of these skills by holding contests. Western education today continues the tradition with competitions between debate teams. A debate contest traditionally has this structure. Teams agree to debate a resolution, a statement, such as nuclear power should be banned. One team is the affirmative team in support of the resolution. One is the negative, against the resolution. Each team gives an argument for or against the resolution. Then, each team asks questions about the other team's argument. After answering the questions, each team makes more statements to support their argument. Finally, they summarize the arguments. In a classic debate, teams may take 12 turns, in which one member of the team speaks.
Professor Charles LeBeau teaches English and debate in Japan.
There is a huge gap between presentation, which is mostly a one-way experience, and then we have something on the other end of the spectrum, which is discussion. The problem with discussion is that there's no real clear exacting format.
Mr. LeBeau says that most people mistake debate as being mostly a speaking skill. But debate is a more natural kind of discussion than what happens in those classrooms. That is because debate requires understanding the other person's opinion.
The nice thing about debate is debate leads towards a more natural discussion. First, I give my position, then you give your position, and then I would address each of the points in your position and comment on them. And then you would have the opportunity to address each point in my position and comment on it.
In part two of our series, we will introduce a simple method for teaching debate to English learners. Mr. LeBeau will tell how using a graphic helps students organize their thoughts and debate with more confidence.
For the VOA Education Report, I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Jonathan Evans.
Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. American military planners had to make an important decision when the United States entered the Second World War at the end of 1941. American forces could not fight effectively in Asia and Europe at the same time. The military planners decided to use most of their forces to defeat the German troops of Adolf Hitler. Only after victory over the Nazis was clear in Europe would they use all of America's strength to fight Japan in Asia and the Pacific. Because of this decision, Japan was able to win many of the early battles of the war in Asia. The fighting in the Pacific is the subject of our program this week. Japanese planes bombed the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii on December 7, 1941.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii by air, President Roosevelt has just announced.
We take you now to Washington.
The attack apparently was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
The surprise raid marked the first of several major victories for the Japanese. Shortly after Pearl Harbor, Imperial forces attacked American bases in the Philippines. And within days, Japan captured the American island of Guam. Japanese troops landed in Thailand. They marched into Malaya, and they seized Hong Kong. The Japanese also moved into Indonesia and Burma. Even Hitler's troops in Europe had not moved so quickly or successfully. As one American historian wrote later, the Pacific Ocean looked like a Japanese lake. The United States began to fight back. General Jimmy Doolittle led a group of 16 American B-25 bombers that took off from the aircraft carrier Hornet and bombed Tokyo in a surprise raid.
The B-25 was selected because it was small, because it had the sufficient range to carry 2,000-pound bombs 2,000 miles. And because it took off and handled very well.
It was a bold move. The B-25 had never been launched from an aircraft carrier before, and the demands on the planes and the pilots were even greater with the weight of a full load of bombs. Japan's leaders believed no army could stop them. So they expanded their goals and launched new campaigns. That was Japan's mistake. It stretched its forces too thin and too quickly. The military leaders in Tokyo believed that the United States could not resist because American forces were busy fighting the war in Europe. But no country could extend its communications and fighting ability over such a great distance and continue to win. The turning point came in June 1942 in the Central Pacific with the Great Battle of Midway Island. Japanese Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto launched the battle. He wanted to meet and destroy the remaining ships in the American fleet before the United States could recover from the destruction at Pearl Harbor. Yamamoto had 162 ships. The American Admiral, Chester Nimitz, had just 76. But the United States had discovered how to read the secret messages of the Japanese forces. For this reason, Nimitz and the Americans knew exactly where the Japanese ships would sail, and they put their own ships in the best positions to stop them. The fighting between the two sides was fierce, but when it ended, the Americans had won a great victory. Admiral Yamamoto was forced to call off his attack and sail home. For the first time, the Japanese Navy had been defeated. The next big battle was at Guadalcanal, one of the Solomon Islands in the southwestern Pacific. Guadalcanal's beaches were wide and flat. Japanese officers decided to build a military airbase there. The United States learned of the plans. American commanders decided that they had to prevent Japan from establishing that base. United States Marines quickly landed on the island. They were joined by troops from Australia and New Zealand. But Japanese ships launched a surprise attack and destroyed many of the American ships in the harbor. Allied forces on the island were left without naval support and suffered heavy losses. For 6 months, the two sides fought for control of the island. Historian and naval officer Samuel Elliott Morrison described the fighting this way in his book, The Struggle for Guadalcanal.
For us who were there, or whose friends were there, Guadalcanal is not a name but an emotion, recalling desperate fights in the air, various night naval battles, frantic work at supply or construction, savage fighting in the sodden jungle, nights broken by screaming bombs and deafening explosions of naval shells.
The fighting continued seemingly forever, but finally, in February 1943, the Japanese were forced to leave Guadalcanal. The battle was an important defeat for Japan. It opened the door for the American and other Allied forces to go on the attack after months of defensive fighting. But American military planners did not agree about the best way to launch such an attack. Admiral Nimitz of the Navy wanted to capture the small groups of Japanese-held islands in the Pacific, then seize Taiwan, and finally attack Japan itself. But General Douglas MacArthur of the Army thought it would be best to attack through New Guinea and the Philippines. The American leadership finally decided to launch both attacks at once. Nimitz and MacArthur both succeeded. Nimitz and his naval forces moved quickly through the Marianas and other islands. General MacArthur's troops attacked through New Guinea and into the Philippines. American ships defeated Japanese naval forces in the battle for Leyte Gulf. Throughout the Pacific and East Asia, the fighting continued. Many of the fiercest battles were fought on tiny Pacific islands. Japanese troops captured the islands early in the war, and they quickly built strong defenses to prevent the Allies from invading. Allied military leaders found a way to defeat the Japanese plan. They simply avoided the islands where the Japanese were strong and attacked other islands. But sometimes the Allies could not avoid a battle. They had to land on some islands to seize airfields for American planes. The names of these islands became well known. Tarawa in the Gilbert Islands, Truk in the Marshall Islands, Saipan in the Marianas, and other islands including Guam and Tinian. The two sides fought fiercely in the Battle of Iwo Jima. And on Okinawa, Japanese forces resisted for 83 days before finally being defeated by Allied troops. After the defeat at Okinawa, many Japanese understood that the war was lost, even if Japan had not yet surrendered. Emperor Hirohito appointed a new prime minister and ordered him to explore the possibilities of peace. But both sides still expected the Allies to launch a final invasion into Japan itself, and everyone knew that the cost in human life would be great for both sides. But the invasion never came. For years, American scientists had been developing a secret weapon, the atomic bomb. The code name was the Manhattan Project. President Harry S. Truman made the decision to use it against Japan.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
American planes dropped one of the bombs on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. And another on Nagasaki 3 days later. Exactly how many people in those two cities died from the force and heat of the blasts, or later from radiation, may never be known. The Radiation Effects Research Foundation in Japan estimates that between 150,000 and 246,000 died within 2 to 4 months of the bombings. Japan surrendered on August 15, 1945, 6 days after the Nagasaki bombing. Suddenly, sooner than expected, World War II was over. More than 50 million civilians and soldiers died during the 6 years of fighting. Germany and Japan were defeated. The Soviet Union was strong in much of Eastern Europe, but the United States found itself the strongest military, economic, and political power in the world. Our story continues next week. Our program was adapted from a script by David Jarmel. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.